time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for December 29th, 2018, the last show of the year. This evening, we're going to talk with the president of the PBMA, James Stanfill. What does it stand for, you ask? The Professional Bicycle Mechanics Association. Over the many years of being in the bicycle business, there have been several attempts at giving bicycle mechanics some sort of certification, as well as offering a forum for advice, information, and education. The PBMA was formed for exactly those reasons and more. As bicycle shops dwindle in numbers and online retailers take a larger and larger chunk of the bicycle market, the opportunity for bicycle mechanics who do not own their own shops will continue to diminish. And while many enthusiasts are able to work on their own bikes, others are not as confident or competent to be their own mechanics. It's a conundrum, and we'll speak with James in a moment. After a break, we'll wrap up 2018 with our man in the know, Dan Worry. From the controversy over Chris Froome and the decision by Sky to end their sponsorship at the end of 2019, to the 2018 Worries, Awards, and Velo News, we'll cover the topics that made headlines in 2018. Before we chat with James, though, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you, the listeners, for your interest, encouragement, and support throughout 2018. Many of the conversations and topics we covered throughout the year came from you, as you generously shared your ideas, connections, and interests via our social media as well as personal message. There's still a lot of cycling to cover, and I hope to bring you some great stories, book reviews, and conversations in 2019. Happy New Year to you all. So let's head down to Austin, Texas, for a conversation with James Stanfill. Hello, James. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Happy holidays, and thanks for joining me on this holiday week.
Thanks for having us.
It's my pleasure. So, you know, I've been in the bicycle business probably longer than you've been alive, and I've seen some meager attempts to put together an organization in which bicycle mechanics, technicians can exchange ideas, techniques, education, etc. And now you and the PBMA, the Professional Bicycle Mechanics Association, are filling that role. I'd like to know about the organization and your role in it.
Sure. Happy to share what we're doing anytime we can. We started this in March of 2016 with an idea to create something that really promoted and advocated for what it is bicycle mechanics do within the industry and eventually outside of the industry in terms of, you know, the consumer-facing side of it when we're working on a consumer's bike and interacting with people and their property. The third part of that is building development opportunities for mechanics. Things like technical training and professional development and networking. You know, a lot of mechanics work in a small shop, and it's good for them to know that there are other people out there doing the same thing that they're doing in other places.
Yeah, that's true. And I've been watching, you know, the industry for so long and wondering what it's going to take to bring all these people together and to improve status. I can remember a story back, oh my God, it must be 30 years ago, that a young man came to me and he said, well, you know, when I get a real job, and it just struck me in that moment how unprofessional it must feel to these bicycle mechanics who come in every day, work their butts off, and then people look at them like they aren't professionals. And they are. They absolutely are. I appreciate that that's the work you're going to be doing. What are some of the challenges for bike mechanics at this time?
Shops are closing, which make it hard to find employment. many shops are looking for mechanics and can't find mechanics because, as you just mentioned, people come to the industry as a mechanic and it's a part-time job or a full-time job through college or something like that. And then they typically leave to go to their career. Many of the long-term mechanics have stuck it out, but aren't, you know, really seeing the earning potential that they should. And a lot of that is, you know, because bikes are looked at as toys. They're sold in department stores in the toy aisle. They're sold in other places adjacent to toys. You know, the more we can move bicycles away from that mindset into what they actually are, which is machinery that take a skill to make function properly, the better off everyone will be long term. Comes down to, you know, safety and training a lot of times. And I think if a lot of people who ride bikes knew exactly what their mechanic doesn't know, they might think twice about what it means to be a professional bicycle mechanic and what those people are and do and what they know.
So one of the things I'm seeing with the closing of chains like Performance, and then there are smaller stores. Last week I spoke with somebody in Philadelphia who said Trek has come in and bought 15 of the small stores. Mm-hmm. Is what it's going to take to keep bicycle mechanics coming into the industry and staying there. So obviously higher wages, better working conditions. I mean, the same thing everybody wants, healthcare. How are mechanics being certified by you guys in a way that elevates them to those kinds of, you know, perks? They aren't perks. They should be just normally given to them.
Yeah, I mean, you see in other industries, let's look at a typical retail business person would come in and work as maybe their first job is as a cashier. If they show potential, they get training and they move into some basic management. If they show potential there, they get more training and they work into store management and so on and so forth up through the skills to where they're doing district management or area or training or other things. But within that industry, they're receiving training paid for by the company to help the company succeed by keeping good people in place with the company. In the bike industry, you know, most mechanics are left to find that education on their own. Some companies in our industry do a really good job and make it really available. Others don't do such a great job. We created some workshops that are three-day hands-on training events where the mechanics show up and get training directly from the manufacturers, and it totals about 27 hours of hands-on time, plus some business development stuff, plus some, you know, networking opportunity. What we see the good mechanics doing is starting to work for themselves. They might open a service-only place like I do here in Austin. They might invest in a vehicle and do mobile where they're able to go to the consumer's house, or they're doing pickup and delivery and bring the bikes and the things back to their workspace and working on them and then dropping it back off when it's ready. But these allow the mechanic to earn a little bit more. We can't just go to a bike shop and say, look, you got to pay this person $25 an hour. You know, there is no extra money to just throw out there and pay people more without showing how there is potential to earn more or bring in more money into that business.
There are some new skills that are needed today to be a bicycle mechanic. I mean, you have a lot of electronic stuff, you have hydraulics, you have a lot of changing standards, which aren't standard, that's sort of like an oxymoron, changing standards, you know, different head tubes, different bottom brackets. How are you taking the members into this newer way of looking at bikes, you know, that you really need to be up on this stuff? Things didn't change for many, many years, and now things seem to be changing very quickly.
Yeah, I think we see on a cycle about every 2 years, there's some crazy shift in technology or something really new. I mean, you've got Rotor Bike coming out with a 13-speed system. So it's a 1x13, you know, we've seen Shimano and SRAM and Campy delving into more gears. Electronics is obviously huge. So we built a basic certification that lets the mechanic test their basic skill. There's an online element that's very much focused around safety and practical knowledge. There's a hands-on element that continues that thought, in addition to being able to build and assemble the bike in a proper fashion, but knowing the torque values and things that are associated to safety when it gets to the assembly element. And then that tells us that this person understands the basics and they're doing the basic things in a safe manner. But also, to remain certified with us, then they need to have a certain amount of ongoing education that has a 2-year requirement and a set number of kind of training hours. And that ensures us that they're going out every few years and getting those updates. You know, if someone introduced a new technology, most likely within the hours of we're asking, they would have got that training from either the manufacturer or through some other avenue where it's available.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with James Stanfill. He is the president of the PBMA, Professional Bicycle Mechanics Association. It is the first time since I can remember that an association has come together or a group has come together in the many, many years I've been in the industry that looks like it's going to stay together, that it's not going to just sort of fall apart and not continue to grow and be productive and give bicycle mechanics sort of a status they've never really had before. So I know you've partnered with CABDA, for example, mm-hmm. and you'll be going out, I guess, to Del Mar in January and Schaumburg in February. What kinds of things will you be doing with them?
CABDA, so we run all their educational programming. We build the schedule. We talk to the vendors that want to do education and help them create something that's of value for the person attending the CABDA show. Then we'll also offer certification. We have a booth there where we talk to people about what we're doing and, you know, shake hands and meet people. Face-to-face conversations are always good. You know, you touched on something there that, you know, we're not going away and we're not getting smaller, which is all true. And that's because our board of directors are all, for the most part, working mechanics in the industry in various roles. And that's important to the core of the mission. It's something that we all care about because we've made our career out of it. So that's always going to drive the organization to continue to be successful.
And that's something I want to talk about, this idea of career and being a bicycle mechanic. So I'm seeing sort of a turn away from four-year college. You have to get a bachelor's degree. You have to do this. Yeah, that people are actually looking at trades. And I consider this a trade and a trade that's worth something. So you would never go. This is one of the pet peeves, big pet peeves, I think, of all of us. You would never go into your auto mechanic and say, what do you mean you charge $65 an hour or $85 an hour or whatever? And yet people will come into a bike shop and think nothing of saying, what do you mean it's going to cost $100 to, you know, fill in the blank, tune up my bike, whatever it is. And yet it's a perception that the bicycle mechanic doesn't deserve that kind of remuneration for the work that he or she does. So how do you think you change that in the public's eye? What is it that the mechanic can do to make the amount that he's worth okay with the consumer, the person who's buying?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the industry, you know, that's a conversation with whoever they work for, whether it's himself or a shop. And it's not just, you know, making the mechanic's career sustainable. We have to make bike shops sustainable. Otherwise, bike shops will cease to exist. Anybody that shops for a bike now, they're much more readily available online, but you can't necessarily just buy a bike online and expect it to show up and ride it. There are some models for that, like Canyon, for example, has done a pretty good job of delivering bikes in rideable condition, but there's still a little bit of stuff you have to do once it arrives to your door. More business will go direct to consumer like that, which is going to cause bike shops more hardship in trying to stay open, if we think about it that way. And if the bike shops aren't open, then the mechanics don't have a place to work. So our theory is that shops and mechanics in the industry need to really focus on service, whether that's the technical service, working on the bike, or fitting services, or anything that the shop does that could classify as a service, that's going to become important to their community. About cycling services, you know, bike shops will really struggle and suffer. And to give you an idea of what a mechanic earns, because people don't talk about this, and I think that your program here is a perfect place for a consumer to understand the back end of what's happening in the shop. The average mechanic gets paid $15 per hour. Now, I don't know if you've looked at jobs recently, but you can go flip burgers at McDonald's or do a lot of other things for that or more in many places nowadays. My challenge is to look at that and understand it and start understanding what it is that goes into the bicycle that you're riding. Safety would be my biggest statement to anybody that goes to a bike shop. Is the bike safe when it comes out? And if we continue to say, look, $15 an hour is acceptable, I will tell you that the product coming out of the shop in 2 or 3 years' time will not be safe.
Yeah, it's like a $29.95 tune-up. There is no such thing. I'm sorry.
The rates that shops charge, you know, that they base their service charges on, haven't changed in 10 or 15 years on average. The pay for the mechanic hasn't changed in 10 or 15 years on average. So I would challenge anybody to name me another industry that that's acceptable in, for the industry or for the consumer. Great for the consumer. You're getting really good deals out there, but it's not sustainable. It's causing problems now, and it's going to cause more problems in the future.
How are pedal assist e-bikes affecting the marketplace? And again, you're going to need different kind of training for that.
I mean, I think that they're great because, you know, people who buy cars understand cars complex. Now they're getting a bike that's kind of like their car. You know, it's got a key, it's got a power button, it does this, it does that. So they kind of respect and understand the value of that servicing that device. Parts on them wear out much quicker than a regular bike just because of the general wear and tear and use that they get. But we see that our industry, the bike industry, is so loosey-goosey, let's say, that you've got other companies entering our market that understand business and do business very well.
Like who?
Like Ford and Chrysler and these other companies getting into e-bikes. Are they going to sell those in bike shops? I seriously doubt it.
Right, you'll go to the car dealer and buy a bike.
Yeah, exactly. It would be nothing for them to carve out a little footprint in their dealership and put bikes in there and hire someone from the bike industry or not, train them on the product and all the things and sell bikes and service the bikes right there. There's a Ford dealership in every town that I know of.
Sure.
To me, that's scary to the bike industry. For mechanics, they'll be able to find work there. You know, if that's successful, mechanics can shift over and work there. And that industry respects what the mechanic does and already pays them well. Good for mechanics, but it's bad for the bike industry, in my opinion.
That's really interesting, James. It's something I had not even considered. Wow. How interesting. Yeah. And you know, as I said, you can go into your auto mechanic. Nobody's going to argue with whatever they want to charge. You know, that's the price per hour or whatever it is. Are you talking with bicycle mechanics about how to be business people?
We have some business development stuff in our workshops, and we've put some stuff out about, you know, ways to make more money and ideas. We'll do more of that over time.
Oh, well, you're answering my next question, which is what are some of your goals going forward?
Yeah, I mean, our goals are always going to be the same, promote, advocate, and develop. And those three things are all very well tied together and move in and out from one another very well. We're developing people. We're training them and showing them new ways and other ways and things they need. And then promoting and advocating, you know, talking on this program is good. You know, the more people that hear about what we're doing, the better it is for the mechanic in the shop. It's a professional bicycle mechanics association, but mechanics work in shops. So we have to care about that stuff too, you know, places where they work.
We do indeed. Wow. We'll be watching. So is there anything right at the end here you want to say other than the fact that we're getting the word out to our listeners and there is a PBMA Facebook page. You're not going to approve people to join it, but can people go out and read it?
No, it's a closed group, so you need to be working in the industry in some way typically to be a part of that group. We have a business page where we share a lot of information. Everything on social media is at Pro Bicycle Mech, and that's an easy way to follow what's happening or trends or ideas or news. We pretty much put it out across, you know, Instagram and Facebook and Twitter anytime there's something worth talking about. There's a newsletter people can sign up to if they want direct information to their inbox. That goes out about once a week. So we'd like to keep people informed in what we're doing or ideas in the industry, and those are the ways to get that data.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see what my listeners respond back with after this conversation, you know, because I know a lot of people try to do their own work. It'll be interesting to hear what they have to say based on what you've said, because I think it's been a very clear indication of how the industry's going and what's going to be important going forward if you're going to stay riding a bicycle for the rest of your life. You know, because it's really important. I thank you for talking with me. Hope you have a happy holiday. I will see you at NABS, I think, in Sacramento. I'd love to go to Del Mar, but I don't think that's happening. So have fun in California and Schaumburg, and thanks.
All right. Thanks for the time.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. James Stanfill is the president of the PBMA. If you are interested in what the organization is doing, you can find out more at probma.org. So let's take a break, and when we come back, we're going to wrap up 2018 with Dan Worry. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This year, we saw Chris Froome embroiled in a controversy that came to a head only a few days before the Tour de France. Now Froome's popular Sky team faces loss of sponsorship. Lance was in the news again, and we lost one of the most popular and famous voices of our sport, Paul Sherwin. Dan Worry is back with me to talk about these topics and more. Hi, Dan. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. Happy New Year.
Hey, Diane. Happy New Year. It's always great to be with you.
Yes, and I know people are anxious to hear from you. It's our year-end wrap-up. It's our last show for 2018, and you and I have a lot to talk about.
We do.
I know. I have a whole list that you sent me of ideas, and I'm like, ooh, I like them all. So let's see if we can kind of hammer through them. First one is about our buddy Chris Froome and the controversy of Geraint Thomas's win. Tell me about the, as they say in Europe, controversy.
the Tour de France this year, quite a controversy leading into it. Not so much with Geraint Thomas's win, but certainly lots of controversy going into the Tour this year. You'll recall that Chris Froome, after winning the Giro this year, had what they call an adverse analytical finding. So it wasn't necessarily even at the time considered a doping positive, but definitely an unusual finding related to a post-stage test taken during the 2017 Vuelta a España. This was for a substance called salbutamol, which many of your listeners may actually be familiar with. It's a very common asthma medication, common in asthma inhalers. And, Chris Froome is well known to have exercise-induced asthma, and so has been a salbutamol user permissibly. The issue here in this case was the unusually high concentration of salbutamol in his urine sample from the Vuelta. And so it really cast a lot of doubt this year as to whether he would end up being stripped of both the Vuelta win from last year and also the Giro win from this year. And then maybe even more significantly for Froome as a multi-time winner of the Tour de France, really threw into question whether or not he would be able to compete. The Emery Sport Organization, or ASO, which owns the Tour de France, was lobbying only days before the Tour actually to have him excluded because of this. But ultimately, just a couple of days before the Tour began, I believe it was July 2nd, the UCI cleared Chris Froome. And so, this was, not a substance that is banned. It was a substance that was permissible in certain quantities, and he had to sort of prove his case as to why that quantity was elevated. But ultimately, the UCI did let him race, and going into the Tour de France in July, but things didn't turn out quite the way that
right.
maybe we expected for Froome in the Tour de France. Ultimately, he came in for the fall, and his teammate from Sky, Geraint Thomas, 32-year-old Welsh cyclist, ended up winning that race, which was something of a surprise in and of itself. Thomas had been a domestique, obviously. If you're a domestique on Team Sky, you are at the top of the heap. Certainly, no harm in being a domestique and the multi-time Tour de France winning team. But it was a little bit of a surprise. Thomas, best known earlier in his career as a track cyclist. He is a multi-time Olympic gold medal winner in the team pursuit, also a former world champion on the track and the team pursuit too, and certainly had some strong results. Leading into the tour, won the Criterium du Dauphiné this year. Has previously, I think, back in 2016, won Paris-Nice. So, a very accomplished cyclist in his own right. But I think we were all kind of waiting with bated breath throughout the tour. Thomas had a bit of a reputation, and people were sort of waiting for this all to fall apart and for Froome to come back as his teammate and sort of overtake him. But boy, he never had a weak day, and it took it right into Paris. So congratulations to Geraint Thomas, and then to Froome. Ended up in third place behind Team Sunweb's Tom Dumoulin.
Wow. It's kind of nice to see somebody besides Chris Froome win, and somebody from his own team. Is how could he be upset about that? One of the things I want to back up a little bit about the controversy that first came along. A lot of people said, well, he bought his way out of this. What can you say about the exchange of money and the rich team that Team Sky was, and we're going to talk about that going forward.
It was.
Yeah, I know,
interesting,
right?
Punctuation.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, certainly, with the backing of Team Sky, Chris Froome had the opportunity to have all of the resources in the world really kind of behind him in this anti-doping inquiry. But ultimately, I think the science just wasn't there. There was some question about the. I think the suggestion was that he took it within permissible doses, and there was a question then about whether dehydration, for example, would increase the concentration of it in the urine sample. So it's in a case that involves Team Sky, there's always going to be that accusation. The team is almost 10 years old and has sort of been. An easy target for fans for a long time, just because of the absolutely disproportionate size of their team budget.
So let me remind our listeners, we are wrapping up 2018 with our friend Dan Worry from Velo News, and we alluded to it a moment ago. End of Sky's sponsorship going forward. What's going on with Team Sky?
That is a big story. So if your listeners aren't aware, Diane, just a couple of weeks ago, Sky Media announced that they would no longer be the sponsor for the Team Sky cycling team. Now, that becomes effective at the end of 2019. So what that means is that the coming year will be the final year that team will exist, at least as Team Sky. Now, the organizers, the team is hoping to continue and is promising to work on finding replacement sponsorship for the team and hoping to announce that by the time the Tour de France rolls back around this coming July. But definitely kind of a shock. I mean, not a shock in a lot of ways. I think over the years you and I have talked about a number of different teams where the title sponsorship has come and gone, and it is a part of the sport where we're sponsorship is such a big part of keeping a team at the highest level. It's definitely not uncommon for sponsors eventually to move on to other priorities with their sponsorship money, and that's not necessarily a bad thing or a poor reflection on the teams in any way. But it's especially unusual in this case with Team Sky, given that is the team that has won the Tour de France 6 out of the past 7 years.
Right. I
mean, this is a team that has been phenomenally successful and, obviously one would think, an asset to Sky. It's hard to tell. We've talked in the past. There have been, particularly over the past 2 years or so, has been more and more of a cloud sort of hanging over that team. Allegations, dating back to Bradley Wiggins' time on the team.
Yes.
Related to possible doping violations and much controversy in the UK about the use of corticosteroids potentially on that team. And then, certainly Chris Froome's, adverse analytical finding here this year. It's hard to say, and certainly Sky has not said that these this sort of anti-doping cloud, has influenced in any way their decision. But, you know, it's hard to say, that it certainly couldn't have helped with their decision. We don't know that it was a cause behind their discontinuing their sponsorship, but, certainly not something that as a title sponsor you want to have associated with your brand.
Right, right. Well, and BMC has chosen not to go forward, but I think they've already picked up a new sponsor.
They have. They'll be called Team CCC this year. I don't recall what CCC even stands for. But
CCC Cubed.
Yeah, that's right. CCC Cubed is the new team. It's interesting. You'll see, they have just unveiled their new team kits. They're decked out all in orange, and so it's very reminiscent of the Euskaltel team of days past.
Yeah. Who's going to be making their bikes? Do we know? Because obviously it isn't going to be BMC.
No, it is not going to be BMC. And I'm trying to recall off the top of my head, Diane, who their bike sponsor is. And I'm coming up blank on that.
You know what? Google will help all of the listeners figure that out.
But it is not BMC.
Right, right. Well, we have another really, I love using the, we have to use it once, Armstrong, of course. But the Armstrong case has finally been settled. And now Floyd Landis got paid because of the settlement. He's funding a cycling team. Tell us about that.
Well, it's really interesting. For years now, Floyd Landis brought up a lawsuit against Lance Armstrong back in the year 2010. The federal government decided around that time not to pursue any sort of criminal charges against Armstrong and the organizers of the U.S. Postal Team related to the doping findings there for U.S. Postal. But they did choose early on to join in on that lawsuit that was originally brought by Floyd Landis. The case stretched on for, many, many years. And in, for a period of time, it looked like Armstrong himself could have been in very serious, financial peril. They were talking about a potential judgment in that case, upward of $100 million. And so, not probably terribly surprising that case was finally settled back in April. Lance agreed to pay out a little over $6 million. Five or so of that went to the federal government, and a little bit more than a million, I want to say it was $1.75 million or something in that neighborhood, went actually directly to Floyd Landis, who then also shared in a portion of the settlement with the federal government as a whistleblower in this case. So Floyd Landis then ends up with about $2.75 million out of this lawsuit. It is much less than people were imagining that that Floyd might end up with.
Wow, it's more than I would have thought.
Well, had it been a $100 million verdict, he would have been somewhere in the $25 to $30 million
of course
range.
Of
and
course.
So, it's interesting. You'll recall, Diane, over the years, there were some many cynical voices that were sort of lashing out and saying, the Landis was only doing this for money, and he kept. Reiterating that was definitely not the case, that he wanted to do what was right in this case. And so I think he has sort of proved himself in this regard. By the time his attorneys were paid out, the big chunk of that. And so what he has done is he is taking about $750,000 of that settlement and is investing it in a UCI Continental team that will go under the banner of his new CBD oil company, Floyd's of Leadville. Although I think there's some discussion that it may actually just be Floyd's Racing now, because there are some limitations, particularly in Canada, around the use of a sponsor name that would be connected to the marijuana industry.
Right. That makes sense.
So, but Floyd's Racing will be happening for the coming year, and is sort of the remnants now of what was the silver team out of Canada. And so, just a really unusual turn of events, here at the end of 2019. If you,
2018.
If we had been talking a year ago or 2018, yeah, of course, if you had told me, when we got together last year to kind of recap the year, that we would be going into 2019 in a place that Sky, you know, the winner of the past, you know, six out of the past seven Tour de France's, was not going to be a sponsor in cycling, but that Floyd Landis, of all people, would be. I'm not sure I wouldn't have laughed at you.
You would not have taken that bet.
It really is a pretty remarkable story. Now, you know, an interesting side note, I don't know if you saw any of this news coverage here recently. You know, there was all of this discussion about Lance Armstrong and his, you know, the concern that this, you know, potential $100 million ruling could, you know, could ruin him financially. What would become of his family? Well, so, you know, it has come out here recently that Armstrong, you know, during this period, made a $100,000 investment in a venture capital firm that was one of the very earliest funders of Uber.
Right.
And so, you know, we don't know the figure, but we, you know, there has been speculation in the media that Armstrong could have parlayed that $100,000 investment into something upward of $1 billion.
I know.
Now, for being one of the original investors in Uber. So rest assured, Lance is doing just fine.
Is that hilarious or what? It's sort of like the guy continues to fall into what we used to call the golden toilet, right?
I tell you.
Can you hang with me? We're going to take a real quick break. We'll
absolutely
be right back. Okay, we're talking with Dan Worry. We are wrapping up 2018. In the sort of competitive end of our sport. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
Okay, we're back, and if you are just joining me, we are wrapping up 2018 with our friend Dan Worry from Velo News, and the next item we're going to talk about is not a happy one, and it's the untimely and very tragic death of Paul Sherwin.
Gosh, Diane, I mean, this is a tough one to even talk about.
I know, right?
I am not the only person connected to the world of cycling who may choke up a little bit having this discussion. You know, Paul Sherwin was, you know, for about a decade, you know, a very accomplished cyclist, pro cyclist on his own. He completed the Tour de France five times. I think he started it six or seven times. You know, not a super, you know, not a giant list of palmares in his cycling career, but was certainly a pro at the very top level. But, you know, people know him more so than as a cyclist, as a commentator. And so, you know, along with Bill Liggett, Paul Sherwin has been now for decades one of the voices of cycling. In fact, you know, most people listening to this program, I would venture the guess, know a fair amount or you know, maybe even got into cycling, you know, and developed their earliest understandings of cycling. Thanks in part to the commentary of Paul Sherwin and Phil Liggett. And so, you know, Paul's death here a month or so ago was a real surprise and is just going to be a real loss to the world of cycling. He died unexpectedly, was in his early 60s, was at his home in Uganda. And so, you know, not a whole lot more is known. I believe his family has released some information and said that, you know, they believe it was a heart failure issue. But such a loss. And I tell you, I don't know, Diane, if you have, has Paul been on the show?
Yes, he has. He has. Well, and I went back and listened to my conversation with him. And I thought to myself, how am I not going to ever be able to hear that voice again? Right.
Oh, I mean, just, and I can tell you from my, you know, sort of limited, personal interactions with him, but more so, you know, kind of electronic, internet, interactions with him. What a gentleman this guy was. You know, I think he and Liggett in certain cases, you know, from some cycling fans, take a bit of a beating because they are associated with kind of the legend that was built up around Lance Armstrong.
True.
But I tell you what, they just you know, I can say I know Paul certainly much better than I do Phil. Cycling commentary is a very hard job. I don't know if you've ever had an opportunity to try to do that, but I can tell you I have.
No,
it is not pretty. It's much easier, and people are very prone to sort of armchair quarterback this on the internet as they watch races and can be very critical of errors that are made. But I tell you what, you know, typically as a commentator, you are sitting in a sweltering hot booth with a small television set in front of you, and imagine not having the commentary of Phil and Paul there, and having to develop this from scratch just from a video feed that is coming in with the ambient sound. There's just nobody better than those two guys. And so, but a lot of flack is caught. I wrote actually several years ago a column in Velo News about my unfortunate experience trying to commentate. It wasn't that bad, I will tell you, but I will tell you that Johan Bruneel was watching from Belgium and offered some very pointed criticism on online,
of course he did.
Which was not a pleasant experience. But it's a very tough job, and I wrote about that in Velo News. And Paul reached out to me after that, and for years since then, we have he and I maintained kind of a behind the scenes kind of private chat going on through direct messages on Twitter and otherwise. Just a really sweet, gentlemanly guy, and he's going to be so missed.
Well, what's really interesting is how much data, information, how many facts, how they knew all the riders, and how they were able to continue that stream of consciousness kind of coverage of these events that you and I would like, oh my God, we'd need like reams of paper. And they had it in their heads also. I know that they had some of it written down, but they really understood racing at such a different level than whoever's just watching it once a year, if they're watching the 3 weeks of the Tour or the Giro or the Vuelta or whatever. So yeah, he will be missed. And what a cool guy he was. Such a cool guy.
Very neat guy. Boy, yeah. It's going to be very...
I wonder what they're going to do. You got any ideas who they're going to pair Phil Liggett with?
I don't know. I would assume that Phil Liggett will continue. And if you've been watching, coverage here in recent years, they have rounded out that, obviously Bob Roll,
right,
Christian Vandeveld, and, a number of other players have been involved in that. So I wouldn't be surprised to see some combination of those guys continue on. But I will tell you, as a Tour de France, viewer and fan from way back, I mean, I can't recall a Tour de France without those voices. And so,
yeah, me neither.
It's just going to be very, very hard, especially come July, to not think a lot about Paul.
So there are two other things I want to talk about. We are going to cover the 2018 Worry Awards in Velo News, but I wanted to talk a little bit about women's racing and what you see for 2019. There's been some really good press for women in 2018. There have been some great wins. There have been some retirements. There's been, just been a lot of stuff going on. Do you have any sense of how 2019 is going to look for the women on the circuit?
You know, women's racing continues to evolve and grow, and hopefully we will see more in the way of I think there has been some discussion. I hate to say for certain because I didn't check before, but I believe that we're talking about a 3-day event now connected to the Tour for 2019.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So, we're seeing that progress. The Colorado stage race, I think, for the coming year is going to move to a women's only race for the UCI as well. And so, some great developments. I can tell you, as a follower, especially of American women's cycling, we've seen some pretty prominent retirements here. Megan Garnick, for example, has hung up her cleats here in the past year. Mara Abbott about a year ago was out of the mix, and so it's going to be a great time for some new faces to come up. Corinne Rivera is certainly somebody that will continue to watch.
Yeah.
and really, I think, becomes America's most prominent female road cyclist. So it'll be great to watch her on the international stage.
So this is a little off topic from what we've been covering, but I'm wondering if you have any sense of how the changes in the cycling business world are going to affect cycling. For example, ASE filing bankruptcy, all the performance stores closing, Trek buying up a bunch of bike shops around the country and opening Trek stores. Do you see anything there that may affect positively or negatively the racing world?
You know, it's interesting to look at that. It's, you know, the one thing that I thought maybe you were going to mention that you didn't, you know, the cancellation of Interbike this year as the industry's biggest and most prominent trade show just sort of not existing. And so it's an interesting time. I will tell you, I'm definitely a follower more of the sports side than the industry side here, but a tough time. I've noticed, you know, here even on, you know, it probably won't surprise you to know that I'm connected to lots of cycling folks on Facebook and elsewhere.
No.
And a fair number of, pretty prominent local shops shutting down here in
right.
the past couple of months that I've noticed here too. So, an interesting time. I wouldn't be a great one to make too many prognostications about the industry, but definitely seems like changes are afoot.
One more time, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dan Worry. We're going to end our conversation today with his awards in Velo News. All right, what you got?
Absolutely. Well, the end of the year is the time when a lot of publications do their lists for the year, their best and worst, and their awards issues. And Velo News is well known for doing a year-end awards issue. You probably know, Diane, my column tends to be a little bit more irreverent. And so I have used my awards, the Worry Awards here for the past 6 or 7 years to highlight some of the more fun aspects of the sport. So I'm trying to, let's think about who gets a couple of Worry Awards this year. One of them I can tell you was Phil Guymon, who
the Cookie Monster
not long ago. You remember the Cookie Monster himself was. Had a book out this year called Draft Animals, which I definitely recommend to all of your listeners. And if you haven't done it, did you get a chance to talk to Phil about that book?
Not that book, no.
Well,
no.
You need to get him on and talk a terrific book about his years with the what is now the EF racing team, formerly Garmin, and
right.
It seems like a different name each year. The sponsors come and go, but. Phil talked about his time in the Peloton, and one of the things that he referenced was this very old rumor, certainly unsubstantiated, that certain riders in the Peloton may have used motors in their bikes. And
right.
He referenced an allegation about Fabian Cancellara from years ago, which made, as you might not be surprised, made Mr. Cancellara a little unhappy. There was a flurry of lawyers' letters, and there was a suggestion from his attorneys that the entire book needed to be pulled off of shelves. That didn't happen, and cooler heads did eventually prevail. But Cancellara actually challenged Guymon and said, you think I'm using a motor? Why don't you bring your bike and let's go head to head. He has a series of Gran Fondo events that he organizes now in Europe, and so he sort of challenged Phil to come out and race against him. At one of those events. Now, Phil, being the very smart guy that he is, chose to race him on the steepest uphill climb. Guymon, well known as a climber, and Cancellara
right.
certainly not well known as a climber, but maybe the best time trialist to ever participate in the sport. And so, to his credit, I think Phil's brains won out over Braun there, and he was able to defeat Cancellara. And what was a great thing, he has put together a series of YouTube videos called "The Worst Retirement Ever," where he has taken on major hill climbs and documented his win over Cancellara. So there was an award for Phil Guymon. Another prominent one that springs to mind was Adam Hansen. who you may recall, you know, participated, and I'm going to blank now on the exact number, but a ridiculous number of grand tours in a row. We, you know, we think about, probably some of your listeners who are into the sport can think about the sense of accomplishment, maybe the first time they rode 50 miles or 100 miles in a single ride. And then you think about the Tour de France being, you know, like 1,200 miles. Well, Hansom managed to ride, something in the neighborhood of like 17 grand tours in a row, which Jessica, you know, didn't miss a single one, would ride the Giro, the Tour, and the Vuelta back-to-back. For years and years and years. And so that streak was finally broken this year. But I have given him an award for the sturdiest undercarriage, essentially, because he certainly has to have developed a few saddle sores from that.
Yeah, you think?
So I'm trying to think. Who else won an award. I meant to bring the magazine and have it here in front of me.
It's already published?
It is already published.
Well, you know
it's
what?
On,
listeners
on
can just go out to
now.
Yeah. You can just go out and look at your current Velo News and find out what the other WARI awards are for 2018. Now, Velo News has their own awards, and you have your awards, so yours are a little bit different from theirs?
That's right. Their awards are a little more serious than mine.
I don't think yours are not. I think they're serious in a whole different way. They're seriously funny. Going forward, what's going to change for 2019? Anything that you can see that we can wrap up real quick?
Well, gosh, you know, I think that, you know, maybe it's not a thing. Maybe it's not so much for 2019. But to me, the biggest question going forward in cycling is maybe what happens at the end of Team Sky. You know, there has been a lot of discussion over the years about what is essentially a very uneven playing field. When you have a team like Sky that has just millions and millions of dollars in their budget, it sort of equates to other big dollar sports franchises where they, you know, where a single team has a disproportionate budget compared to the rest of the sport.
Right.
And so, the real question I think here is, you know, what will happen and how will things sort of shake out in the aftermath of Team Sky if they are able to, to find a sponsor at an equal level and maintain that kind of dominant presence within the peloton and a real stacked roster. You think about having both Chris Froome and the new Tour de France winner Geraint Thomas on the same team, is just an example of probably both of those guys this year make more individually than many smaller teams operate on in total. And so it will be very interesting to see if they'll be able to match that level of sponsorship and keep that going. And if not, you know, where do these big dollar riders go? Do other teams have the opportunity or the budget to even sign them at that level? And then what happens sort of to the general competitiveness of the field as maybe those riders distribute?
Well, so if you look at Cleveland, which of course had LeBron James all those years and he went to LA. If you look at Cleveland's record this year, you might be able to see going forward what might happen because the Cavaliers are just tanking terribly. Well, Dan, as always, it's so much fun to talk with you. You're always so well informed. You know exactly what's going on in our sport from a perspective that I don't get to have all the time because I cover such a broad spectrum of the sport. So it's nice to be able to narrow it down. I know I sent you a book to review. Maybe we'll be able to get to that in 2019.
Maybe in a few weeks, we'll be back together.
Yes, we will. I hope so. Well, I hope you and your family have a wonderful New Year's. Thank you so much for talking with me today. And we will talk again soon.
Sounds great. Happy New Year, Diane.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
As always, Dan WARI has such a great depth of knowledge and understanding of our sport, and it's always fun to chat with him. You can read Dan's column in Velo News. So that's our show for tonight. Thanks to James Stamfill from the PBMA and, of course, Dan WARI from Velo News. And thank you so much for listening. I wish you a happy, peaceful, and healthy New Year. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. Remember to stay safe out there, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.